Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales through Diamond to retailers for February 2018. We've now got about 15 years worth of data here. Of course, going back 15 years, only have like the top 10 or 25 trades, but now we've not only got the top 300 this month, we actually got the full top 500. When we do month-to-month comparisons, I typically do limit that to the top 300 just because that gives us a more apples-to-apples. At least on the trade side, going a little bit further back, but like I said, not all the way the last 10 years. As I talked with Sam on the comic side, we're starting to enter a period of change with previews. We've got Boom and Dynamite getting promoted to premier publishers with the April previews. With the May previews, we've got DC pulling out and becoming its own previews section, much like Marvel has, which really kind of draws, I think, a clear division line between Marvel and DC, kind of the top dogs that are operating just at a much higher sales level than everybody else, by and large. And then those premier publishers, which are kind of those, for the most part, all the mid-tier publishers. Depending how and where you draw the lines, there are a few that don't totally fit into that category that arguably could. And then we've got a lot of those other publishers that, while they're doing some great work, they just don't have the market penetration or the total sales to be at that same level as kind of those mid-tier publishers.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the breakdown of the top 300 trades, unsurprisingly, the top two are Marvel and DC. Gosh, go figure. Marvel had 31.18% of the total units for the top 300 trades. DC had 21.08% of the total units. That works out to about 71,572 units for Marvel and about 48,383 units for DC. Now, on the trade side, it's a much more even playing field than it is on the comic side, so that second group of publishers of the other premier publishers of Image, Dark Horse, and IDW with Boom and Dynamite about to join those ranks, they're up there near the top of the list, but there are a few other publishers kind of interspersed. Image had 15.43% of the total units, Dark Horse had 6.23%, IDW had 4.47%. That works out to 35,413 units for Image, 14,289 units for Dark Horse, and 10,260 units for IDW. Now, between Dark Horse and IDW is Viz. It had 4.62% of the units, or about 10,593 units. So, about 333 units above IDW. And then just to go ahead and start looking at Boom and Dynamite, Boom was right below IDW with 6,938 units. That's about a 3,000-4,000 unit gap between IDW and Boom. Then we had Oni, then we had Hatchet, then we had Dynamite with 3,522 units. That's really working out to about 3.02% for Boom and about 1.53% for Dynamite. And again, with Oni and Hatchet coming between Boom and Dynamite. So it's not as clear cut of a case looking at just the trade side for Boom and Dynamite. It very much is that way if you look over on the comic side, where Dynamite outsold IDW and Boom outsold Dark Horse. So I think it's going to be interesting as we see kind of this shuffling with previews. The only other time we've seen that since we had the front half, back half split of previews was when IDW became the only other premier publisher, or the only other publisher to join the ranks of the premier publishers. And they were in a bit of a growth spurt at the time, so it worked well for them. And I'm not sure we're going to see the same thing with Dynamite and Boom. One, because I don't think either of them are in kind of the growth phase that IDW was around that time. And also, because they're only going to be in there 1 month along with DC. And I think DC moving out of the main previews, if it's the same sort of thing that Marvel has, that's a big change. Because On the comic side, Marvel and DC account for about 80%. Here on the trade side, this month, only about 52%. But I think there are going to be a lot of people who say, you know, I get what I need in the Marvel previews or the DC previews or between the two, and there's less reason for them to go to the main previews catalog.
Yeah, I definitely think over the next few months, it'll be interesting to chart that. One thing I have a question for you. I have not, I'm not sure if the podcast with Sam has been posted. I don't think it has.
It has not. We just recorded that the other night.
Gotcha. For Dark Horse, you know, I do remember in the last comics report that you talked about they had a pretty terrible previous month of sales. And that, and looking over at this month, you know, they're well below the Boom Studios and IDW in terms of the single issues. And in fact, they're taking in more revenue and you look at their trade sales than they are single issues. And I wonder if that's going to be if that's just a blip or if that's going to become for them an issue where they're kind of buoyed by their trade sales. Well, then, and then you have to worry because trade sales for them in a lot of ways stem from their single issue sales. So it's like the leading indicator and the lagging indicator. So I kind of wonder if we're going to also see a drop in their place on the trade market. And then along with that, an interesting conversation, I think, would be one of the reasons I thought that DC was going to its own catalog is because they're going to be really pushing OGNs. And I'm interested to talk about, do they think that do they see just so much more sales outside the direct market like Amazon in that? And then obviously like that book market preferentially prefers, you know, spines and things like that that are much easier to move and much less fragile. And if that's the case, you know, we always hear from people like Brian Hibbs saying, you know, the direct market is predicated on amortizing your cost over the issues. And then, you know, yes, you may make profit on the collected editions. Do you know what I mean? So it's just an interesting, the outside of the direct market may be becoming big enough where these companies are saying, we need to just not necessarily cater to the direct market, you know, and is DC doing that with the going out and got outside of the main catalog?
Absolutely. We should definitely talk about all that. Let's go back to Dark Horse for just a minute and get kind of that.
Sorry. I just had all these ideas hit me at once.
Just make sure we talk about them all. That's all I ask. Let's start with Dark Horse. I don't want to say to get that out of the way, but that's kind of going to be the crux of what I'm going to say. Dark Horse, since they lost Star Wars, has not been in a great place. They've not been in a horrible place, but the last 2 months have been the lowest sales I think they've ever had during the Final Order era. And that goes back to like the beginning of 2003 when we actually started getting invoiced sales versus what stores were pre-ordering.
Yeah.
While I've got a couple of years of that data, I pretty much ignore it because a lot of those things didn't always come out.
Yeah. And I'm just looking at the raw numbers on the comic side, I cannot remember a month when Dynamite Entertainment had twice the single issue sales as Dark Horse. That blows my mind. Now, did Dynamite have some sort of really weird variant where they sold something for 100,000 copies, or is that a loot box or something like that? Or
it's more a matter of Dark Horse over the last month or two has just not been its normal sales.
Yeah, so it's really fallen off. Because I just do not think of Dynamite and Dark Horse in the same category, but obviously if their sales trends continue, they will, you know.
Well, if you look, and Sam and I had a similar discussion on this with Dark Horse, you've got things like Hellboy and BPRD, but they're not coming out on a frequent cadence. You've got Usagi Yojimbo, but it's not like that's a top seller, although frankly it deserves to be. It's a wonderful book. The other kind of anchor things they have really start to be fewer and further between. So they don't have a property right now like Star Wars, or I'm really trying to think of some other historical anchor books for Dark Horse. And not having that, I think, is a lot of what's hurting them right now. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say they don't have a wonderful lineup of properties with things like Rebels, Resident Alien, and other properties. It's just they are I don't want to say a more focused publisher because that's not quite what I mean, but they are a more selective publisher.
Yeah, no, I actually agree with you. I think that Dark Horse, you can kind of get it. You can say that there's a Dark Horse books in a lot of ways have a certain feel, or like you can say, oh, that's probably going to, that looks like a Dark Horse book or things like that. You know, they're aesthetic. One thing I would say that you make a really good point about like having that big property is it creates like gravity, which can draw people in and make them willing to at least sample other books. And I think one of the things they're running into is they have so much of their line is devoted to Mike Mignola's universe. And I think that that has been going on so long that it has its steady state customer base. I think there are between 5,000 and 10,000 more on the trade side, number of people that like that, you know, because in general, Mike Mignola publishes that kind of dark horror adventure comics and kind of like based on folklore and things like that. And, you know, ancient history, World War II, you know, kind of scary monsters from the past. And I think that audience, I mean, he's been doing this for 20 plus years. So that audience is almost kind of set. And so when you don't have these properties that have gravity that draw, you know what I mean? Kind of like that weighted gravity that draw people in, it creates a situation where, you know, I think there's so much choice now that a lot of people sample these series and you end up with below 5,000 units very quickly. And I don't think for certain publishers that's profitable on a continuing basis. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and particularly about kind of that sales gravity, if you will. If you've got a title that's a bit of a magnet or gravity force to get people, it's like, oh, I've got to go check out Dark Horse because of the like the Black Hammer line of books or something. Uh-huh. Then they're going to be checking out hopefully most of what else is offered by the publisher, looking for more of things they're going to like. But if it's I don't get anything from that publisher, I'll skip to the next.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an anti-inertia sort of a thing.
And I think another component that people need to be aware of is this is one of the worst parts of comics, this vicious feedback loop where if the customers don't express interest in a general line, there's only so much shelf space and the retailers can only pre-order if they know they have a reasonable chance of sell, you know, subs plus one or subs plus two or three versus like subs plus 10 because I can sell this. And what I think happens is the stores only have so much rack space and only have so much money each week. And obviously so much of it gets sucked up by the 80 Marvel titles and DC titles getting published that if there's not something like Star Wars to reliably bank on, the retailers are cutting back their orders to just what people subscribe. And there are still a lot of people that go in weekly and what's on the shelf is what they think is published. And that's only what they buy from. So over time, you can see this two-headed monster of, you know, not having enough things people to look at Dark Horse, and then the retailers cutting down their orders to just what people pre-order, and then you don't have a lot of Dark Horse on the shelf, and so then people just look at, you know, there's 60 other books being published, I'll just pick one of these, you know, so it's this self-reinforcing negative spiral.
Absolutely, and that's one of my concerns with DC moving out of the main previews, is, again, we look at these numbers, the overwhelming majority on the comic side is Marvel and DC. But, you know, hey, you've had to go through the previews catalog, pick it up, open it up to get to DC. You may as well look at Image and stuff. If you're there, why not look at, you know, the other premier publishers? Whether you go to the back half or not, not so certain. But now, if you've already gone through the Marvel and DC previews, depending where you're at on your budget, both in terms of how much money you've got left to spend, either as a retailer or as a reader that's pre-ordering, and how much time and energy do you have left, we may really see if this previews fatigue concept from years ago holds water or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because for April, it may actually help Boom and Dynamite, but come May, it may really hurt everybody left in the main previews.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious how that's going to play out. And certainly I know just from my own habits, when I go through my order form and stuff, there are aspects or certain publishers that I just skip over. It's like I haven't gotten much of anything. Or in some cases, I literally have never gotten anything from that publisher. So they must not be to my liking or in my wheelhouse or whatever, however you want to phrase that. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to one that I know has some stuff. And there are others where maybe I'm not getting anything right now, but they've got a good enough track record. I make a point of going through their solicits. And again, if I don't go through the solicits, I'm not going to pre-order it. If a store doesn't put it on the shelf, to your point, a lot of readers don't even know the title exists.
Yeah. And I think that's how you end up with these series at a lot of places. I mean, even Image is having a problem with this outside of their top line creators. Some of these books, they barely start with 20,000 orders for issue number one. And by the third issue, they're down to 6,000, 7,000, even down to 5,000 or below. And with the Image model, that's clearly not sustainable long term if you can barely get past the first trade without having, you know, it below 5,000. And then at Dark Horse, where you have more overhead, quote unquote, you know, I think it makes it really tough.
Yeah, it does. And when we look at the top trades list itself and see where the top 300 kind of ends and then where the top 500 ends, you can do the math depending how many stores you think are out there, say 2,000, say 3,000, and you can figure out in some cases like maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 stores is even getting a copy. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that the trades are gravy, because in a lot of cases it's the necessary income to keep the property going. And the sales on the issues are not the loss leader, but it's to keep the creation going. Mm-hmm. But between the two, it's a rough market out there.
Absolutely. And especially considering what we are used to seeing on the trade side for a number one, you know, for something at the top of the trade, you know, we're often at least used to seeing 10,000 units, sometimes 20,000 units when you get Walking Dead or Saga. And to this month, we have the top of the chart is reorder activity of Saga, and it's only at 3,000 units. Now, I'm not saying only in the sense of that's bad for Saga. That's great because it's just piling on their already success. But to lead a month, to have a reorder lead the month, and then to have the top out at 3,000, that's significantly lower than I'm used to seeing.
You know, I was going to save this for later, but let's go there now. Not only is Saga at the top of the list with reorder activity, I think I can tell you what stands a strong chance, like 80%, maybe more, of being the number one seller next month. And that's going to be Walking Dead Volume 29.
Yep, when that comes out, you're right.
Well, it's funny you phrase it that way, because if you filter the list to just the Image comics on the top trade side, and you go down to rank 459, remember I said we had the full top 500.
Uh-huh.
We have Walking Dead Volume 29 trade paperback with a whopping 194 units. This is the new volume of Walking Dead, and it didn't even make the top 300. Oh my God, what has happened? Well, I'll tell you what's happened. I don't think there's anything wrong with The Walking Dead, although I think we are seeing a softening of sales on it because it's been around and perhaps hit that saturation point. This didn't come out until the first week of March.
Gotcha.
I am not sure why it is on the February order form. Or not order form, I'm sorry, the sales numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was a accidental mistake on the part of Diamond. I know they do some manual manipulation of this list, presumably to weed out things like this, but frankly, whoever wrote the query to pull this out of their database could have done a better job to make sure this didn't show up at all this month. Because it makes me question if these 194 units are going to show up included in next month's or not, and there'll be no way of knowing. But it's just kind of funny to see what is almost guaranteed to be a top seller in the, you know, multiple thousands range showing up where it did.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Because, I mean, this thing should be selling like in the 15, 16, 17,000 range.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So this is what, maybe 2% of its overall sales for next month?
Uh-huh.
Just kind of funny. But it also goes to show what it is about just kind of the luck of the draw as to what comes out in a given month. Only one item over 3,000 units, and that being Saga and its reorder activity. And once you're out of the top 10, you're under 2,000 units. Now, if you figure there's at least 2,000 stores, probably closer to 3,000 of what we would consider actual honest-to-goodness comic book stores, not just stores that sell other stuff and happen to have a few comics. That means most stores are getting a copy of anything outside of the top 10 at best.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get to the bottom of the top 300, it's like, let me double check real quick, make sure I get it right. Yeah, 298 units. So 1 out of 10 stores. Go down to the top 500, it's 174 units. So that's what, 1 out of 20 stores maybe?
Uh-huh.
So if you're waiting to get something in trade and you're wondering, gosh, have they just never collected this? They may have, and it just didn't hit your store. And it's one of those things where for the longest time people would say, oh yeah, be sure to send in your preview spotlight pick for the non-Marvel DC because there's no guarantee your store is going to have them. I mean, that's true now for Marvel and DC properties and has been for many, many years. I knew one store that stopped selling, I forget the name of the title. It was the X-Men title that John Byrne was doing. It was a historical flashback kind of a thing. And it's just nobody at that store was buying it, so they stopped putting it on the rack. That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
You're losing money on it. Why support it? So it was kind of a soft month in terms of certainly the top of the list, and then just, I think, kind of generally for the trade side, where the total estimated units were 229,527 units, whereas the average is around 308,670 units. And this is like the weakest month we've had on the top 300 trades since, hang on, let me continue scrolling up and double check this, potentially since we've had the top 300.
Hmm.
And yeah, I'm not seeing any so far that are below this. Yeah. So it comes down to what happens to come out in a given month and how much do people care, kind of, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a harsh thing to kind of say, but that's just how it is.
Yeah.
And with trades, you've got a couple of different categories, but a lot of these are collections of existing things. And in those cases, you kind of know what the contents are. So you've, as a retailer or a reader, you've got a good sense of, well, was this well reviewed? Did I like this? Did I hear good things about it? Things of that sort to go with. And, you know, this is the, like I said, the lowest, for the total of the top 300. Since we've had the top 300, which goes back to November 2008, and the average sales during that period is 339 units, 339,794 units, and this is about two-thirds of that.
Yeah.
So it comes down to, did they just not have the right books coming out that month, or is there... You know, first quarter is always soft. People still paying off holiday bills or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at some of the items in the top 10 or whatever, and nothing's really jumping out at me as to, wow, this really should have done much, much better. I mean, DC meets Looney Tunes at rank number 3 with 2,924 units. That's pretty good for what that was.
Oh, yeah. For that material, I would actually call that a success.
Yeah. We got a couple of Rebirth trades, Teen Titans Volume 2, Titans Volume 3, Justice League Volume 5. They're not doing bad. Again, a copy or so a store on average. Mm-hmm. Same with Despicable Deadpool Volume 1 and the Astonishing X-Men Bachara Soul Volume 1 trade paperback. None of these sold poorly, but again, it's not a new volume of Saga, it's not a new volume of Walking Dead, or any of the other things that typically would just blow this stuff out of the water by, you know, a few multiples.
Mm-hmm. Quick question for you on the DC meets Looney Tunes. Was that all ages material, or was that a little bit older?
I'm going to say, in my opinion, it skewed a little bit older.
Okay. Because one of the reasons I was asking is because... I listen to a number of podcasts, and they oftentimes have shop owners on, you know, comic store owners. And one of the consistent themes that I've heard from when they talk to the comic shop owners about what is working and what they are expanding in their stores, giving more square footage to, it's the kids sections for all ages, graphic novels and things like that. So I was wondering, with, you know, this, what I would consider relatively strong sales in the direct market for a book that I would think is kind of on the edges like this, maybe it was... if it was shaded to an all ages book, I could see why more stores would stock it, because those are the sections that are stores that are growing and are, you know, turning over more units quickly.
Well, the thing of this is it had about a half dozen one shots, and some were more all ages in my mind than others.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Legion of Superheroes Bugs Bunny special, I would say that was more or less all ages.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the back half, where it was more of a Looney Tunes take on the same story that the front half had. But then when I look at things like the Batman Elmer Fudd special, I think that was more of a nostalgia thing for an older audience.
Mm-hmm.
That a younger one, it's going to be like, where's Elmer Fudd? If they even know who he is.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
And I just, these Hanna-Barbera DC mashups kind of confuse me a little bit, because there's some, it's inconsistent on even the high level approach. Of, are they in a shared universe? Are they intersecting two universes, or what? And are they classic versions of the characters, or are they, like in the Elmer Fudd case, a really inventive Gotham City take on the characters?
Mm-hmm.
And that inconsistency from title to title to title, for somebody like me who likes the shared universe and that kind of a thing, makes this feel a little odd. And I mean, they're doing another wave of them. Mm. And I've enjoyed them, but yeah. I'm not clamoring for more necessarily.
Yeah.
I'm not rejecting more either, but I don't know where they're going with these. I mean, I'm happy that they're using the Hanna-Barbera characters, but I'd rather they do it more in a future quest kind of a manner mm-hmm. than this kind of a bizarre mashup. But I think they're having enough success with it that they're obviously continuing it as kind of a fifth week event, if you will.
I can see why they would do that. Yeah, to kind of fill space.
Yeah, and DC is very much a title comes out once a month or twice a month. Months where we've got that fifth week, either do an annual for some of the titles then and or do some of these titles, you know, throughout that month to fill it or whatever. But yeah, the fact that we only had one item over 3,000 and just barely, and only 10 over 2,000, not so good. And then by rank 71, we're below 1,000 units. It's indicative of it's just a lackluster month, but it's a question of, again, to your other point of how's the direct market doing versus this? I don't know because I don't have a number of units on that direct market sales. I know through BookScan, the top three superhero graphic novels for February were the first three volumes of Black Panther, A Nation Under Our Feet,
mm-hmm.
which show up here at ranks, 14, 18, and the third one's on here somewhere. I think it's further down. Yeah, it's way down at rank 176. So how these sales stack up in the number of units compared to the direct market, I don't know. I am not under the impression, and maybe it's mistaken on my part, but I'm not under the impression that the direct market is becoming a more dominant sales stream than the mass market isn't becoming more dominant than the direct market. And the direct market is non-returnable sales. And we've heard a number of cases over the years where some publishers were nearly, or in some cases actually were, wiped out by strong sales into the mass market that then followed by strong returns from the mass market that they just couldn't cope with.
Yeah.
You know, there have been one or two publishers that did kind of fire sales. If we've got to sell some stuff to absorb the loss of massive returns, it's one of the things that kind of took out cross-gen, although there were a number of other factors there as well. And I think there's a definite strong market in areas in the direct market, but it tends to be more high profile projects, things like Black Panther around the time of the movie, Star Wars, Batman, things of that sort. I would be surprised if we were to ever see like a DC meets Looney Tunes trade showing up well on the BookScan stuff.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, again, could happen. Unless there's another Space Jam movie coming up, I think it's a hard sell.
Yeah, I don't know if we should hold our breath for something like that.
I certainly am not.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the direct market is a much needed outlet. It's a much riskier outlet for publishers. And then the other part of kind of your original question there was around original graphic novels and such.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing some of those. Rank 28 is the Avengers Rage of Ultron original graphic novel. We've also got things like the Earth One initiative at DC. We had at one point the Season One stuff over at Marvel, but that's kind of died away. So I think if we were seeing a lot more original graphic novels, if we were seeing them starting to really be a main force at the top of the list or something, I think an argument could be made that original graphic novels are a major factor. I'm not seeing it.
And so, you know, that's kind of where my question comes from, is that if one of the reasons that DC is breaking out of the main previous catalog is because they're going to be putting some major money and time behind OGNs, I'm assuming from a corporate standpoint that they would have had to justify that to the higher ups, which means that there must be quite a bit of sales potential or sales in the non-direct market, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, things like that. Otherwise, I don't know how they got that greenlit. Do you know what I mean?
Well, hang on a sec. Let's separate two different issues here. First off, there's that new label they're going to be doing for some potentially out-of-continuity stories and whatnot with some high-name creators. But then there's the DC the Black Label, I think it is, yeah. I always confuse that with the premium line of Star Wars figures, so it's it's different, I know that. But
Or whiskeys, but yeah.
I don't drink, so.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, it's interesting sometimes how they market things, it's just funny.
I'm willing to bet they based it on the whiskey, not on the Star Wars action figures, yeah. But I'm just guessing. Either way, the whole concept of are they doing this direct market catalog because of how the mass market is moving, for me, doesn't hold water.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. I didn't necessarily consider that is that, the direct market, people who are outside, people ordering on Amazon probably don't even know what previews is. So that's a very good point.
I think it's to have a perceived equality with Marvel, which has had its own catalog for literally decades now. Probably two, because they've had it for about 20 years since they did the Heroes World stuff in the 90s. And just to get that sense of, I mean, to a degree, when DC does that, you wind up with a three-tier section of what we would call the back half of previews, but we'll need a new name for since they're going to a flip book thing, and it'll now be in, depending which way you flip the book, the front half of previews. But the above that is the premier publishers, and above that is kind of the whatever we would call Marvel and DC that have their own catalogs. So I think in my mind, there's always been kind of that major league, minor league, farm team kind of split of just at what level are they playing the game? And not to say what quality, but just what sales level. And I think what we're seeing now is an actual acknowledgement of those three separate levels to a much stronger degree than we had been seeing before. And then that flip side of previews, I believe, is going to be manga and toys and things of that sort. Much like the further back half of previews is.
Gotcha. When does that start? When is the first previews for that?
April is when Boom and Dynamite move forward, and I think they move to the flip format. May is when DC moves out.
Okay.
But I could be wrong on when the flip format takes a hold.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's going to be a big change, big but subtle change, I guess would be the way to put that. Because it may not have any impact on sales. It may be that Boom and Dynamite moving like 100 pages further forward could help them quite a bit. But we just have so little empirical evidence to go on with that. And it's also a combination of not just that they're further forward in previews, but does this time with big new announcements and releases of high-profile type stuff from Boom and Dynamite. I mean, if this were to coincide with, Alex Ross doing a Superpowers Chapter 3 or something, that could be a big deal for Dynamite.
Yeah, that's true.
If it were to coincide with George Perez and maybe a big-name writer or something doing a mainstreamish kind of a book from Boom, that could be a big deal. Don't know of any of those sorts of things even being remotely, rumored to happen. So we'll see what happens, but, I'm looking at sales on both the comic and the trade side. They're not overly strong. We've been seeing a downward trend on a number of publishers and an overwhelming number of titles, but that part's not new. And I see the reaction from a lot of these publishers as just almost, I don't say nonsensical, but like the new age of DC heroes. By the time we see that on the trade side, I hope we still have the top 500, because I'm not sure how well Silencer, Sideways, Damage, and the Terrifics, I think, will do all right. But a lot of these others, I don't know if by the time we see them on the trade side, if the comic will still be going.
Yeah, no, I think the market has obviously answered the question whether DC should have published those. So.
Well, the message I think DC is unintentionally sending is we need better characters. And I don't think that's true. I think they've got awesome characters, but they're not leveraging them well. So for them to feel the need to have a Fantastic Four kind of a group, a Spider-Man kind of a character, a Hulk kind of a character, a Punisher kind of a character, potentially even a Ghost Rider kind of a character, it's like, really? I don't get it. And then over at Marvel, the confusion and message they're sending is around issue numbering and revoluming. They make this big kind of ambiguous push towards legacy numbering, And then, kind of as expected, within 6 to 12 months, they're going back to new number ones for most of their titles.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's the issue number that's making people jump on or jump off. I think it does play a factor, and you're more likely to get people to sample a number one than a number, you know, 700 and something. But I think that's because they're putting a lot of promotional effort around those first issues. And that's part of why I've let kind of the data cleaning get a little lax, not a little, a lot lax on the trade side here, is how many volumes other than, say, a Saga or a Walking Dead, how many volume numbers do we have over, say, 3 or 5? You know,
not many.
You get down to, okay, it's a Buffy or it's a manga title, or otherwise it's just this series of unnumbered not graphic novels, trades that you look at on a shelf and it's like, well, what order do I read these in? And the truth of the matter is, it does matter. They've got ongoing stories between them, and even between multiple volume ones of a trade. I think it's a bad position for the market to be in, and I'm not sure how they kind of negotiate out of that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I just wonder if, and along those same lines, is, you know, as both the big two see these diminishing returns for certain series that are outside of their, you know, their core groups, you know, outside of Spider-Man, outside of Batman, outside of, you know, we'll see how the relaunch of the Fantastic Four does, but just, you know, a lot of the titles that you quote unquote call, you know, C or D list characters, and then, you know, they start off poorly and they end poorly in terms of sales, not necessarily quality. But so I wonder if the, you know, I can't square this OGN push with what Hibbs talks about, how OGNs are notoriously difficult to sell consistently. And yeah, you might hit on one, but then you have four of them that completely bombed, and you had to pay for all that art creation, and you didn't get to amortize it over the issues. So how does that work? You know what I mean?
I think that's why we see only a handful of original graphic novels from Marvel and DC each year.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that those were kind of big deal things, like the JLA Earth 2 hardcover that reintroduced the crime syndicate. It's like, okay, that's cool. That's big. But a lot of these things, Rage of Ultron, there was the Infinity finale for Thanos. I'm trying to think of some other original graphic novels that are not like the Earth 1 stuff. There's not many, and they're not burning up the sales charts, and there's no story momentum behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So, do I think they should do more of those sorts of things? Actually, yeah, I do, but they need to do it on a cadence that builds up sales.
Yeah.
And I don't feel that they're doing that. You know, even the release schedule of the Earth 1 stuff is a little kind of haphazard. You know, I never know quite when to expect that next volume. And the truth of the matter is, they come out when they're done.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. It's like, I just saw that the other day that the Green Lantern one from Gabriel Hardman's coming out. And I was like, oh, I remember seeing that like 2 years ago, them talk about that.
I've actually got it sitting here in a stack of Earth 1 hardcovers for Sam and I to do another back issue spotlight on as soon as I get around to reading them.
Yeah.
And that's another problem of announcing projects way too far in advance.
Yeah.
And that's part of why I really personally don't spend much time, if any, going to CBR, Newsarama, Bleeding Cool, or any of these other websites to find out, oh, what have they announced? I really don't care. Until it is solicited? I'm sorry, I've been teased too many times on these things of, oh yeah, we're going to do this, it's on the to-do list or whatever, and maybe it comes out 3 years later, at which point it's like, well, it feels old by the time it comes out. So I think they need to, and I get the problem here is on like the mass market side with like Amazon and other bookstores, they've got to have their slate kind of figured out a year or two in advance.
Yeah, that's the tough part, yeah.
And if they put it out there, which they have to, and they don't announce it in the direct market, well, it's going to leak and get there anyways, and they haven't been able to control the message. But we're an immediate gratification audience, I think, and it's not very immediate gratification when you announce, you know, 3 years ago or whatever, you're going to be doing this Earth One Green Lantern stuff. I don't know how they can fix that kind of a problem, but certainly cleaning up the messaging, I think, would help.
No, I agree. It's just hard because there's so many different interests going, you know, back and forth. There's, you know, sometimes the comic buying world tries to go in one direction, and then there's just people pulling in all different directions, and that's part of the problem.
Well, absolutely. You've got a wide variety of reader kind of personas, if you will, out there. You could take the readership and probably categorize them into some finite number of certain people are looking for the mainstream stuff, certain people are avoiding that, looking for the edgier stuff, certain people are what's new, what's different, if I've read it for too many months, I'm skipping and going to something else. Others who want just, hey, I've read this forever and I want to keep reading it forever. So whatever those personas would wind up being, you've got a plethora of them, and they are sometimes overlapping and sometimes mutually exclusive. To please one, you alienate another. And then you've got that same kind of a setup with different personas at the retailer level that act as a gatekeeper between the publishers and the readers, as they should. And it's not an easy thing to figure out how to come up with a product that will sell well and widely, and how to correctly message that to where it actually gets those sales.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a couple of things on the list that this month may not have done amazingly well, but have built up some solid sales, such as that first volume of Saga. We've also got the Infinity Gauntlet trade paperback on here. Batman Flash, the Button Deluxe Edition is on here again. One of the ones I find a little humorous is at rank 70. We've got the Marvel Legacy hardcover, 1,025 units at the $39.99 price point. And this is, as near as I can tell, pretty much just Marvel Legacy number one, the Legacy Primer pages, and a couple of things from that Foom magazine.
Yeah, that's this continues the long trend, and I know your listeners probably, they hear me repeat this. The Marvel pricing when it comes to some of this stuff, especially considering what they like to package, is outrageous.
Yeah, $40 for that is... I mean,
yeah, and think about that, like at a LCS, where with how their business works, they need to charge close to cover price, and like I would be afraid to sell that to someone because they might be disappointed and not come back to my shop, you know?
Yeah, and even if they like it, do they like it $40 worth? And do they then still like it that much when they realize they could have gotten just the Marvel Legacy issue for a quarter of that?
Yeah, even paying full price, which by the time you bought it, if you were interested in it later, you know, it's in the cheaper version, you know? Oh, man. Yeah, never underestimate Marvel's ability to package as few pages as possible for as high as possible.
Well, and I think the repackaging of content is it's a fascinating concept to me. When I was getting out of college, I seriously considered going into comic book publishing. And I had a particular title I wanted to do as a long-form kind of a narrative. And it was going to be, it's like, either I could do this as a 20-page weekly, or I could just do it as an 80-page monthly. Spend a little bit more on the cover, have a little nicer, deeper story per issue, and it just seemed to be the way to go. But then I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be a little more expensive and stuff like that. And this was back in the early 90s. This was actually before Image had launched. And I was thinking, okay, we do this, we come out with 12 issues a year, we have a year-end kind of a, almost a season recap, if you will, just to tie a few threads together people may not have noticed, or just to get people up to speed as an on-ramp if they'd missed it, whatever. But then also, every so many months, I forget if it was going to be quarterly or every 6 months, collect those into a trade, because at the time, that wasn't being done.
Mm-hmm.
But now you look at it, and... using a digital comic as the example, and I've talked about this before, and no doubt we'll talk about it again. You've got the digital issues, two or three of which get compiled into the print issue, six of those get compiled into the trade, two of those get compiled into the hardcover, sometimes two of those get compiled into the, you know, omnibus or complete collected edition. And if you go down to ranks, see if I can find these real fast. 366 and 411. We've got Injustice Gods Among Us Year 1 Complete Collection Trade Paperback, which did 249 units of reorder activity, and then the Injustice Gods Among Us Year 3 Complete Collection Trade Paperback, which did 218 units of reorder activity. Those are collections of collections of collections of collections.
Yep.
That I've lost count of how many dips they've had into it.
It's so funny you say it that way, because that's this way, the year complete collection is that's how I collect that series, because I originally read the very first year in the digital versions, and then about, you know, halfway through that, I was like, oh, this is going to be really good, but I'm a trade reader, so I was like, I'm just going to wait. And then they would put out a hardcover and then a softcover, and then I was like, you know, I lost track of it for a while, and then they announced the series of whole year collections. I was like, oh, I'll get that. So that's how I read them.
As well you should. And James, new co-host on the Weekly Comic Spotlight, has expressed interest in this, and these are the collections I think he should pick up. Mm-hmm. You know, $25, you get the full year. There's like the 5 years plus the Ground Zero, and now they're on Injustice 2 or whatever. So, yeah, you're going to spend a couple of bucks doing it, but you're getting a really long-form narrative that's had some really good payoff over the years. Uh-huh. So it's, but that goes back to a point I've made multiple times before of, I think the publishers are training readers to wait, because when you decided to buy these, you had already foregone the digital. You'd been getting the print for a little bit and then opted not to do that. You decided to skip the initial trade collections, maybe even the initial hardcover collections. At that point, you are in the habit of not buying the property.
Well, and remember I said in the middle of that, I forgot about it for a while, and then it came back, because I do something that's a little different than I think a lot of people. A lot of people, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. I keep a multiple page long running list on Amazon. You know, you can have a wish list.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'll go, because the nice thing about Amazon is they'll show you up to 6 months to a year before stuff comes out, even further out than previews on the collected editions of graphic novels.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll go through there and kind of give it a window of for new stuff, and I'll just go through and add them to this wait list, you know, kind of like almost like a wish list for – I think it's – the idea for Amazon is to get people to buy you stuff off your wish list. But for me, I just keep it as like almost like a big spreadsheet. And then every once in a while, I'll go in there and see what's coming out, and then I'll know what I'm interested in. But a lot of people, if they don't keep it in mind, they just forget it even existed.
Well, and there are a couple of things that I'll put in my cart in the save for later section on Amazon. Uh-huh. With, I want it. I just don't want to pay that price for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, my sister turned me on to the service called Honey – that will actually tell you if there's a better deal. You know, if you get it from this other retailer, you can save a couple of pennies or something. And it has a price watch feature. Because there's one thing, it's like, I don't want to pay that price, but if it goes less, I'd like to buy it. And it dipped below that, but then dipped back up before I was able to pull the trigger on it. So if anyone knows of an Amazon sniping utility.
Yeah, there you go.
I'd be of interest in that. In other words, put it on my list. If it drops below a threshold amount, just go ahead and buy it. Although there's probably some danger in that too, but still.
Yeah, definitely want, maybe it should ask you first, but yeah.
Well, the problem is sometimes they'll dip it below to like a half off sale for a few hours.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just to be able to say they had it that low or whatever, which is one of the advantages of pre-ordering something on Amazon, is that's how I'm getting a lot of my Blu-rays these days. And if it ever dips lower than what I purchased it at before it ships, it'll give me the lower price.
Yeah, that's definitely.
So there's a certain aspect, I think, with all of the stuff to consume these days, of being an intelligent consumer, finding the best discount, finding ways to save the money so you can afford to buy more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is so materialistic of me.
Well, you know, we have voracious reading appetites, so we need more stuff, right, John?
Absolutely. And I'm cheap. I want to spend less.
Yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff here. I was surprised with the softness of the reorder activity on Walking Dead this month.
Mm-hmm.
And again, at one point when we were talking about this title on these episodes, we would see the full gamut of titles, and they were selling pretty robustly. The first volume of the trade only did 644 units of reorder activity, followed by 28, then volume 2, then 27, then 3, then 26, then 25, then 4. With, of course, that anomaly of some earlier sales for volume 29 there.
Mm-hmm.
But all said and done, and this is across both the top 300 and the top 500, it only sold a little under 3,300 units. And if we look just within the top 300, it sold only about 1,931 units. And this is one of the more evergreen kind of titles out there. It's got the support of the TV show. Kirkman is just now kind of widely known. Mm-hmm. And it's not like these are bad sales, but as I've wondered with many titles over the years, like Watchmen, etc., any of these evergreens, when do they kind of hit that saturation point where pretty much anyone who would want to get it has had the chance and they've gotten it?
Yeah.
I don't know. And again, no doubt when 29 properly hits the list, it's going to do gangbusters.
Oh, yeah.
So just kind of weird there. So one of the other ones that was a collection of a bunch of one-shots that did all right. Ranked 29, we got the Jack Kirby 100th Celebration Collection trade paperback, 1,481 units from DC. That was a bunch of those one-shots, the New Gods special, the Newsboy Legion and the Boy Commando special, the Sandman special, Manhunter special, and Darkseid special. So not one I expect to be like an evergreen of any sort or whatever, but, you know, it did all right.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, it outsold the Avengers Champions crossover right below it of the Avengers Champions Worlds Collide trade paperback. And that did 1,459 units, so it outsold it by, 22 units? So not by much, but, you know, by a little bit.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, there's just always a certain market. Well, at least for the next few years, while those people are alive for Kirby Comics, you know, the people that appreciate his work.
You expecting them all to die off soon, or what?
Well, what I mean by for a while is, you know, in 20 years, those people, you know, there is a certain mathematical reality.
Yes, there is. For some of us, we're a little further down that path than others, I guess.
You know, if I go to 20 to 50 to 100, I'm pretty predicting that within 100 years, most of those people will be no longer with us.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I was emailing with on the Slack channel with Eric a couple of weeks back, and Mage came up as a topic, and it turns out I think I am like potentially the only customer at Cowabunga that buys it. And when he told me that, I'm like, does your audience just skew younger than I am or something? He's like, yeah, kind of, sort of. In other words, he was politely saying I'm an old geezer. No, he wasn't.
Well, that's really interesting because that's considered one of Matt Wagner's two great works, right?
So absolutely.
That and Grendel, and the fact that he's finishing it has kind of been, was a major, I don't know, I just, and you know what? You know, a lot of the podcasts that I listened to were really stoked that he's finishing it, but those guys are also in their 40s, you know, so it's just a different demographic.
Absolutely. It comes down to, do you remember the previous Mage series?
Yeah.
And that was, one of them was in the 90s. Was the other like 10 years after that in the 2000s? I forget when the others came out, but they were a while back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think in one of the solicits they had, it was like the first time he'd done any work on it in like 15 plus years. So it's at least that, you know?
Yeah. I just couldn't remember if that was the second volume or the first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the second, because I think the first either came out through First Comics or through Eclipse or Kamiko. I forget which publisher it was. But again, it goes back to certain demographics have certain things that you can push the nostalgia buttons on. You know, if you were to bring the Justice Machine back, there's some people of my age who'd be, hey, that's cool. They're going to be newer readers of, hey, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the way the market works when some of these things go out of circulation for a while, and it may as well be a new property for newer readers.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then you know, I actually like the way that Matt Wagner draws, but I think that there's a certain aspect of his drawing style that says 1990, and some people, you know, each era has different kind of style acceptations and different, you know what I mean? The same way that Sam Keith was accepted and glorified, you know, in a certain era. And now some people might be put off by his art. Some people might open up the current Mage to browse through it to see if they want to jump on and then just not be in tune with the art because it is in some ways from a different era. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And there are a couple of things that are on the list that are reprints that surprised me, such as the Batman and the Outsiders Volume 2 hardcover down at rank 121, which is reprinting Batman and the Outsiders, like number 13 through 23 and stuff, by Mike Barr, Jim Aparo, and some others. And that's like classic 80s stuff, which I love, but it's like kind of a why now? Although with what's going on with Dark Knight's Metal and them actually referencing that group of Outsiders, it kind of makes sense. But then also at rank 43, we've got Aquaman by Peter David, Volume 1 trade paperback, And that's collecting some of his stuff. I think it was the Time and Tide miniseries and then the original 8 or 9 issues of the Peter David series. And that did like 1,233 units. And again, why that? Why now?
Yeah, that just seems like a strange...
It's one of Peter David's bigger properties at DC. He was really widely well-regarded for that, as well as Young Justice, among the various things he's done at all of the different publishers out there.
Mm-hmm.
He falls into that category of a couple of creators that I just don't think really get their due at times.
Absolutely.
The other one that I don't know why they're doing it now. It seems completely untopical. It's at rank 117. It's Superman President Luthor. I don't know why that would sell in this day and age. Billionaire president. I don't get it.
And then also, like, I've seen the trade dress for that, and it just doesn't look appealing. Like, have you seen the front cover for that thing?
I have not.
Yeah, it's just it's like a picture. It's like a presidential picture, like him posing for a presidential picture with like a red background. It's very, I don't know. Yeah, it just doesn't look appealing to me at all.
If I had to guess, I'm willing to bet that was the cover for Lex Luthor, the Unauthorized Biography, which is reprinted in there.
Okay.
If it's the image I'm thinking of, it's not even the most flattering of Lex.
Yes.
So, but again, this is stuff that I believe was done back in the 80s, but I'm not positive of that. Mm-hmm. That was also some of Peter David's stuff, among others. So maybe it was Peter David Appreciation Month and I just didn't get the memo. Another one that's kind of interesting is if we look at rank 143, we've got 614 units of reorder activity for the trade paperback of Flashpoint. It's totaled up to a little over 33,000 units. But up above that, at rank 127, we've got Flashpoint Unwrapped hardcover, 686 units, and this is the same story but presented in the original pencils.
Oh, okay.
So I'm curious if anyone's gotten that and if they enjoyed that or whatever. But kind of interesting, it barely outsold the trade of the story. Granted, the trade of the story is about half the price. About half the price, a little over, of the Flashpoint Unwrapped hardcover.
Yeah, it's interesting because I just am not I'm just not the audience for that stuff. I never particularly focus on the extra back matter material. So a collection like that for me is kind of almost a non-starter because I'm like, I could just get the regular version and not pay the extra money.
Yeah, well, and apparently a lot of people did.
Yeah.
I mean, to a degree, I would almost pull a Disney move and put a few of these things, quote unquote, in the vault, and then do the premiere version of it that's got the optional extras. So if you want a copy, you're kind of stuck doing that. That's probably not a very nice thing that I might do, but I could see the temptation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We've also got a little bit of a perplexing one. It's down at rank 170. It's Legends of Tomorrow, the Atom trade paperback. And at first I'm thinking the Legends of Tomorrow, the anthology series they did, I don't remember the Atom being in there. That's because he wasn't. This is referencing the CW show, and it's got Showcase 34, Secret Origins 29, the Atom Special number 1, Giant Size Atom number 1, and Justice League of America, the Atom Rebirth number 1. So clearly they're trying to get a little bit of a crossover market here. It sold 523 units. So I'm going to say didn't do all that well in terms of getting it.
Yeah, I think some confusing marketing there.
Well, again, that's one where you're using a different title's title.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird. Now, I think they should reprint like the Sword of the Atom and some other stuff. They've had some classic runs, Power of the Atom for that matter, of the Atom. But yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those characters that for people like you that are all in, he has various points in the DC history has been very important. But for people that dabble in DC and drop in and out, I would say he's one of those C or D list characters. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I would say in the last decade or so, the most prominence the character has had was Identity Crisis.
Uh-huh.
And even then, not used, I thought, particularly well. But if you go further back, Satellite Era Justice League, you know, the 80s and such, they were doing a lot with him.
Okay.
And that's part of why that whole delineation of C-list, D-list characters or whatever, it fluctuates over time. There are some that are much more relevant at various periods than others, And it doesn't take long, kind of off stage, if you will, for a character to go from, I recognize him, I know who he is, to, who the hell is that again? The shelf life, I think, or whatever, the half-life or whatever is pretty short on some of these characters.
Uh-huh.
And the Atom is one that they've struggled to know what to do with, because they went from a classic science-based character in the 60s to Justice League members in the 70s and 80s. After that, he almost became a little bit of a sword and sandals kind of a thing with the Sword of the Atom stuff. Later, they brought him back, they rejuvenated him, and had him as a member of the Teen Titans.
Ah, gotcha.
So they've been kind of all over the map with him, and now the Iron Man take on the TV show. So we do have a couple of other event kind of a books showing up in reorder activity. Kingdom Come with 386 units of reorders at rank 236. 246, Blackest Night did 370 units of reorder activity. And there are a couple others kind of scattered on the list. Civil War down at 293 with 303 units of reorder activity. So there are a couple of the things that, since they've had a prolonged impact on the narrative universes, are showing up, you know, just periodically. Presumably, stores saying, hey, I've sold the copy or two I had, I better reorder.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, another thing, going back to your comment about original material, is if we filter the list to the DC Superhero Girls titles, we've got three of those on the list. Volume 4 at rank 352 with 259 units of reorder activity. The first volume, Final Crisis, at rank 431 with 209 units of reorder activity. And then what I believe is Volume 5 at rank 470, Date with Disaster, with 188 units of reorder activity. This is original material, not exactly in the same class as, say, as original graphic novel set in the mainstream universe, but, you know, we're seeing some success with this, but it's also one of the things that makes me think, if I were an editor at DC, how much would I be investing in original to trade graphic novel or digest or whatever you would want to call that? How much would I want to invest in that approach?
Uh-huh.
And I think making an investment there makes sense, but making a large investment in there doesn't. You're just better off, I think, generally serializing the material. Unless you've got something that needs that longer form story in a single shot to really work.
Mm-hmm.
So what else looked interesting to you?
Well, I just wanted to note, like, up near the top, Lumberjanes, Volume 8, first series of orders, and that's about 1900. And I just, the reason I highlighted it, not because I even read this series, but this was kind of one of the breakout series for Boom. And you say, oh, 1900 units, that's not terrible. I mean, it has made it to Volume 8. I think Boom and IDW are very consistent in their line that when they publish collected editions at the trade paperback level, it's 4 issues. So that means the series is up to around 32 plus issues. But I just want to note that this series is probably much more popular outside the direct market at Amazon and Barnes and Noble, because when I go to my local Barnes and Noble, there's almost like half of a shelf that's just like for Lumberjanes and related, like, you know, kind of teenage girl graphic novels, Raina Telgemeier, those kind of things. So just to remember that sometimes we talk about these numbers and some people may say, you know, the entire direct market sold 1900 units. How does anybody in this business make money? Well, there are other parts of the market.
Well, and this is hitting a target audience that frankly doesn't really go into comic stores.
Yeah. In large quantities. Yeah.
You know, if I were doing something targeting a very fundamentally different demographic than you find in the comic stores, I would not rely on the direct market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things that will do better in the mass market as, I don't say as exception cases, but because of either the easier access or the different demographics. You know, things that have a high mass audience awareness, Star Wars, things of that sort, are likely to do well in the mass market. Likewise, those that are hitting a niche market that is fundamentally different than those of us gravitating as Wednesday warriors to the comic stores. Lumberjanes is a great example of that. I'm trying to think of some other good ones off the top of my head, but there's certainly a lot of, I think, cases. The Archie Digest and stuff, they do well in the mass market, not so much in the direct market. It's to me, I think the direct market is the controlling force for most comics, but I think there's also kind of that maybe, you know, it's the 80-20% rule. 20% of it is going to be the ones that know their fate's really decided elsewhere, through Scholastic, through digital, through the mass market, through libraries or something like that. And I think that's good, because those act as an outreach program, hopefully to drive people eventually towards comic stores to find other things in this medium than, you know, they can find at the mass market.
Mm-hmm.
But that Lumberjanes is also selling about twice what the next best-selling thing for the month was for Boom.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I will say that, you know, it is very solid for them. It's just that I know that in the other markets they do even better, which is great, you know, great for them. They kind of – this was one of those series that they started and then definitely it initially started as like a four-issue, you know, limited series. And then it was successful enough, they expanded it to 8. And then I think around issue 5 or 6, they just saw the numbers coming back so successful that they just took the miniseries name off it, you know?
They've done that with a few other things. Mech Cadet U, I think, was one of them, and
Giant Days as well was
Goldie Vance, I think, was another.
Yeah, and it was like Giant Days is a little different in that John Allison had already kind of created a cartooning empire over in England and Europe. He's very well known with a bunch of other kind of like online comic strips that he kind of publishes daily or weekly, and he kind of had his own thing, but. You know, this was more of a, let's see if this works in the direct market with a, you know, published in the comic book format versus the comic strip format. And it was successful. You know, they're up to volume 6 or 7 on that. And like you said, the Goldie Vance. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so. Again, different audiences are going to gravitate towards different things. I think the direct market certainly favors the superhero genre over a lot of others. Not that other genres don't do well, but there's not kind of that genre bias in the mass market. Likewise, in the mass market, I don't think there's the publisher bias that we see in the direct market. Mm-hmm. So if you've got something that will do well or okay, at least in the mass market, while you're competing with a lot of other books and stuff like that, I think within the realm of graphic novels, trade paperbacks, etc., you've got a little bit more of a fair playing field there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in those places, I don't think the potential reader is looking at the spine saying, oh, it's Marvel or DC. Oh, it's not. So, but there are going to be some people doing that too, but I think it's a much, much smaller kind of occurrence.
Interesting.
It always surprises me how publisher biased the audience can be in the direct market.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have a different perspective because you read all of the comic, you know, DC and Marvel for the most part. So you kind of ride out the waves, but there are times when I think that what DC and Marvel are publishing is not good, and I just completely abandon them and go to other publishers. But I have such a wide version of reading that there, and like we talked about, one of the downsides right now is there's so much being published, but if you're able to just find what you like, then it's also an upside for you, right?
Yeah. Well, and yeah. I think part of why there's a publisher bias is shared universes and people saying, I've got to draw a line in the sand somewhere. Mm-hmm. Here's a convenient boundary they've already put out there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's not like somebody's not going to watch a television show because it's on CBS versus ABC versus NBC or something.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, and you're right in that sense is that, you know, when you get people arguing online about, you know, DC versus Marvel, and you see it even in the movies, you know what I mean? Like, when someone doesn't like one of the DC movies, the other people call them, you know, a DC hater and a Marvel lover, and it's like, no, I just didn't like the movie. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah, but if you were to come out with a new superhero movie and after producing it were to slap a label of either Marvel or DC on it,
mm-hmm.
it would do better if it had the Marvel label because it's a stronger label in the movie universe now.
Yeah.
There's power in that, but it's also because of the audience bias. I've liked other Marvel stuff. I'll go check this out. I haven't liked DC movies. I won't go check that out. I mean, I get why it happens, but it's painting with a broad brushstroke and not really looking at the individual properties sometimes. But there's also a case where some books don't fit well in a given line, and there's a cognitive dissonance there of what is this book doing over here? The Boys, when it was published by any imprint of DC, it's like, this doesn't feel like a DC book. It's not that sensibility. Sure mm-hmm. enough, DC realized that within about 6 months, and it went over to Dynamite, where it lasted till issue 72 or something. But then we've also got some things like the Young Animals line that I think part of why it's struggling is it's not mainstream DC, it's not mainstream DC, and it's just a little confusing as to it's neither fish nor fowl. And I've seen a number of titles, particularly at DC, struggle with that. Less so over at Marvel, because they tend to have fewer of those sorts of should it be here or not kind of titles.
Yeah, it's a tough market.
Yeah. Now, I don't know where they pulled the art for this, but the Color Your Own X-Men New Mutants trade paperback at 157. You can obviously color your own stuff. It is, I'm skimming the thing to see if it'll give me a clue. Cannonball, Wolfsbane, Mirage, Danny Moonstar, Sunspot. So it looks like early New Mutants. I point that out because this is a color your own comic kind of a thing. If you're looking for an adult coloring book, this may be a good one to start with, provided you've got a lot of black pencils and yellow pencils, because that covers most of their standard X-Men uniforms at the time. You need a little bit of red to put around the X, I believe. But other than that, it's pretty simple. I did flip through one of the Power Ranger ones, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but it was surprising how, other than the helmets, without the colors, I was having a hard time telling the Rangers apart.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, do your checking first before committing to the wrong color. We seem to be seeing fewer of these coloring books. I don't know if it's just played itself out or if that's more of a mass market kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think in the direct market, it just isn't as big a seller. And obviously, I think there's a certain aspect of it, of being a fad, you know, like come and gone.
Well, and I think those books have a longer usage life.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it can take you a while to color in the whole book.
Yeah. And also, the other thing is that I thought you meant that the other way, in that unlike single issues that kind of, you know, are almost unable to sell after a week or two, the coloring book should, you know, it's not like a new version of it comes out the next month. So that can kind of, if you just have a few of them sitting on your shelf, you have that covered if you need it, you know?
Exactly, exactly. You would get it because it's a different property, not because it's necessarily a different new, you know, New Mutants kind of a coloring book or something.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I do want to see somebody take one of those, scan the pages in, and use it to show off their actual comic book coloring work versus just doing it by hand.
Oh, that would be funny.
Because if you're thinking about it, if you want to try your hand at being a colorist, that may be some great art to start with. It's got the line work you need.
That is a good point.
So the middle of the list this time around for the top 300 was 581 units. So half the list did more, half did not so well. Again, a little bit soft, but for February, I guess that's not too surprising. Not too uplifting either, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is just, I don't think that all of this stuff needs to always get collected to trade. And then getting collected multiple times to trade doesn't help either.
Yeah, I think that's one part of it too. And I wonder if over time there'll be, as the economics of it become, you know, if there continues to be a very low sell through rate on, or, you know, low number of issues sold in the direct market for the comics, that they'll be like, yeah, there's no financial justification for this to go to trade, but we have it available digital. You know, I wonder if at some point the major companies will decide it's available digitally, so we're not like missing out for our fans. Yes, you could argue that the digital reader is completely different, but it's just one more checkbox where they could say, well, we really don't need to collect this because it's available in another format.
I think that's a great point, because I think a lot of people, if they miss the issue and they're really wanting to stay with the story, they may go digital for that issue versus mm-hmm. having to go buy the full collection. I think the collections are getting more geared towards those who want the thing with a spine to put on their bookshelf, put on their coffee table or whatever, want that better printing of the material.
Yeah. And it may become, John, depending on how far that goes, because the thing you then have to worry about a little bit is if you do that, if you annoy the paper reader enough with the digital, or on one hand annoy them that there's no collected edition, or if they dabble in digital enough that they're like, hey, this is just better, I don't have to store stuff, it all just stays in the cloud, I can download it anytime I want, then you may have this reinforcing loop that you're sending more people to digital, which shrinks the direct market, which you know.
Yeah, but I don't think we've seen any evidence that the direct market is particularly shrinking as a result of digital.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
The range that we're seeing the top 300 trades and comics in, really, it's bouncing around in the same basic area it's been doing for 15 years. And Day and Date Digital's only been around for, what, 6.5?
Yeah, that's true.
But I do think that there is a subtle delineation of the audience happening there, much as people who preferred issues or trades either over the other. We've now, again, got that third prong of they prefer the digital. But even in cases where, like the Vigilante Southland that we saw the collection of that reprinted all 6 of the 3 issues that were published, they could have done the other 3 as digital releases, and they didn't.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So I'm not sure where that's fitting in terms of the overall publishing mindset. I mean, we're seeing it as a content creation stream that then is getting collected to print, whereas if digital was as strong as some people might believe, they wouldn't really need to go to that print issue. They could just go straight to trade later down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we weren't seeing things like Injustice as issues but had to wait for the trade, then I would say, okay, digital is doing all right. It's able to sustain the cost of content creation long enough to get it to the trade, and then maybe prints a little bit more as single issues in danger. But I'm not seeing that at the moment. But it is just another prong. And of course, we don't have sales information for digital. We don't have a number of units on the mass market either. So for me, it's always a little hard to compare those two to how the direct market is doing in terms of number of units. You know, it's easy to say this thing is doing strong over there, but do we have any numbers to back that up?
Yeah, and I know that you have the book scan or the book list, and sometimes that kind of gives you a general idea if something is successful, but yeah, it's not nearly as good as the diamond numbers, that's true.
Well, it tells you what is more successful than something else, but yeah, it doesn't give you a sense of is it successful in a more empirical term.
Yeah, that's true.
For example, on the top 20 superhero graphic novels from BookScan, we've got the 3 Black Panther Volume 1, 2, and 3 of Nation Under Our Feet. They could be separated by units or by tens of thousands of units. We don't know. Whereas here on the the Diamond side, because we've got the order index, we can do that calculation and get it to an estimated number of units.
Yeah, and I would expect to see, you know, actually, I would expect to see maybe a small variance in volume 1 and 2 outside the direct market, because, you know, sometimes like a lot of that uptick obviously is like the popularity of Black Panther. And so the parents, you know, they take their kids to see this movie. Ooh, we love Black Panther. Let's go get some comics. They go to Barnes & Noble. The first couple trade. Okay, I'll get you the first one and maybe the second one at the same time. So those sales probably are a little closer. And then not as many people like it, or they just don't like comics or whatever. And then the third volume probably is quite a bit less sales. You know what I mean?
Or they just haven't gotten around to reading it yet.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, too. Yeah.
So I think there's a definite aspect of what we're seeing there with the Black Panther stuff, with the number book one being the number one seller. It's not the newest release. This is people who are looking for a starting point off the Black Panther movie, which is one of the few cases in which we're seeing a movie actually driving sales towards, in this case, the mass market. But typically there's not as clear of a starting point. But I think part of it is because of the notoriety of this particular author, Ta-Nehisi Coates, there's a perceived good starting point, and they're kind of ignoring all of the back other Black Panther Volume 1s they've got, of which one of them placed, I think it ranked 12 on that same list.
Gotcha.
So there's a little bit of a... When you've got 8 Black Panther Volume 1 trades to pick from, or however many there are, it makes it a little harder and it diffuses the sales effort, whereas I think Marvel's trying to funnel it a little better this time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But nice to see people are enjoying the movie enough to say, hey, let's go read something.
Yeah, for sure. And interestingly enough, and you know, obviously this is tough for our end when we analyze the sale of the books, I see so much Black Panther merchandise at stores like Target and Walmart and everything, so they are raking in lots of money on the merchandising side. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if you've been into those type of stores lately, but they have entire displays set up in the middle of aisles for this kind of stuff. You know, everything from masks to outfits to stickers to, you know, a little props. You know, it's just there is a lot of money they're making on that. It may not necessarily be printed comic pages, but they're making a lot.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think helps the publishers, is they don't need to make money hand over fist on the stories, because they can license it to the toys, the t-shirts, the posters, and everything under the sun.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a number of people I know who more often than I do are wearing superhero-themed shirts. Mm-hmm. And I know they are not more of a fan of superheroes than I am. I'm just going to kind of put that out there as a strong theory. But, I mean, they're fans of the material, and I think that's awesome. And if they're good with the movies and the TV stuff, that's great, too.
You know, and on a certain level, if, you know, as Marvel's continue to be successful and hopefully DC moves in that direction, you know, it generally reinforces to the upper executives the importance of the IP that is the comics characters. And, you know, the good version of that would be that you hope that they continue to see that as valuable and continue to publish comics. The downside, they may just decide, oh, well, if we could just have the IP farm and not the other side of it, it would be even better. But, you know.
I would say the one company that I've seen do a move that actually showed they value the creation of new material was Netflix and the Mark Millar deal.
Uh-huh.
Because he's spent a lot of years building up a library of properties. Mm-hmm. And granted, most of them didn't see more than a single story told, but they were good stories.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. A couple of them he'd actually go back to. But then I look over at Marvel, that's just doing more titles of existing properties. DC, that's doing more titles of Marvel properties, actually. You know, and I'm not seeing really the new, the innovative, the different.
Uh-huh.
And that does kind of worry me, because if the assumption, erroneous though I believe it to be, is that they've got the wrong characters at one of these companies, create new ones. I mean, don't use that as an excuse. Come up with a theory as to why your sales aren't where they should be. Test the theory, and then if it works, keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But that just doesn't seem to be happening. I mean, if it was, we should be seeing a couple of more titles doing better, because while these stories were so great, if you missed them in the issues, you've got to get them in trade.
Yeah.
But it's easier to go for the safe bet than the risky one. We've got like 17 items in the top 500, about a dozen of which are in the top 300 of Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an easy go-to kind of a thing. We've got the movie coming out, stock up on the stuff. So I think the retailers did the smart move doing there. Hopefully they moved all that material, and hopefully they've gotten a couple of new customers as a result.
We can only hope, right?
Yeah. Well, because right now movies and TV shows are the best on-ramp into comics we've got these days.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And in some cases, I think they're being more successful than others. But at the very least, the days of these properties and reading about these characters being seen as childish or otherwise pejorative, long since gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having an in-depth knowledge of the history of these characters is now seen as beneficial conversational material versus that's useless trivia, who the hell cares? Yet the sales are still where they're at, so go figure.
Yeah, right.
If we look at the price points, $19.99 is the most popular, followed by $9.99, that's nice. And then probably, let's see, $14.99 and $24.99. We do have a couple of things at the higher end of the spectrum. One item at $100, four at $125. But I would say most of the items are in the $20 or less. Yeah, about almost three-quarters of the items in the top 300. So still gravitating more towards the less expensive than the more expensive. And a couple of those $9.99 things are like the DC Superhero Girls or One Punch Man from Viz or Royal City from Image. Again, first volumes of stuff from Image tend to be at that price point. Which again, lower barrier to entry, get the people in. If they like it enough, they'll come back for the next.
Absolutely.
Anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think that pretty much does it for us. I will be continuing to kind of track, you know, I'm a big fan of the Dark Horse, BPRD, Hellboy material. So I really enjoy that stuff in collected edition, especially the library edition. So I am, my antennae are a little bit up for Dark Horse. I'm a little concerned for their long-term health. Now, I know that Mike Richardson, who runs it, he's been doing it for 20, 25 years. So he probably, you know, has ways to help his company out. But I just get a little worried because I think that they publish quality material and I don't want to see them have to do things like some of the other companies that I don't think have good practices. You know, I don't want to see him have to employ certain things. So I hope that their health turns around a little bit, and hopefully we won't see some of this drop off in sales translate from their single issues to the collected edition. So that's something I'm going to be monitoring the next couple months, just because I'm interested and enjoy Dark Horse books. So,
well, Dark Horse has, like you said, a long history, and yeah. My understanding is they're based in the LA area, and that Richardson has some other things beyond just the comics. I mean, Dark Horse has been behind a couple of TV shows, movies, etc.
That's true.
So I'm hoping that the company is financially sound for the long term and can weather the not-so-great period the comics section is going through right now with no problems.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
But I do think they need to find kind of that next sort of anchor property and really get rolling with that sooner rather than later. So with that, we'll call it an episode.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.